Next case this morning is A201382, State of Minnesota versus Derek Lamar Forrest. Counsel, as you probably know, each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. While we have the separate stands for you to argue from, the timer is on the center podium there, so make sure you're tracking that. And we will record these arguments and post them on our website. Therefore, it's helpful for you to make clear who's speaking. And if you could state your name and who you represent at the beginning of your argument, we would certainly appreciate that. Counsel for appellant, you may begin when you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Devi Axelson. I represent the appellant, Derek Forrest. Mr. Forrest's conviction must be reversed because his attorney was ineffective when he failed to request the lesser included offense of second degree unintentional murder, which, when viewed in the light most favorable to the verdict, was supported by the facts in this case. The district court, in its PC motion, agreed with at least one part of the Dahlin test for us and concluded that Mr. Forrest had established that there was a rational basis to convict Mr. Forrest of that lesser included offense. It, however, disagreed with us, and that is for review de novo, both things are before this court, on whether or not there was a rational basis to acquit him of the more serious offense. I don't think that this court or the Supreme Court has specifically addressed whether that has already been met in this case, because Mr. Forrest was acquitted of the most serious offense that was lodged against him, first degree premeditated intentional murder. But if the review is based on whether there was a rational basis to acquit of the convicted offense, second degree intentional murder, that the facts, when viewed in the light most favorable to Mr. Forrest, also support that. What the court is aware of from reading the briefs from the parties is that this whole altercation started with Mr. Davis, who's the deceased, when he came up and violently attacked Mr. Forrest and stabbed him pretty grievously, according to the police officers who viewed Mr. Forrest after the accident. Mr. Forrest, in the small little parking lot area, made multiple attempts, I think, to hit Mr. Davis with his car in a smaller space, which again, I think, establishes that he was intending to assault Mr. Davis and not necessarily kill him. And then the lead up that led to Mr. Davis' death was Mr. Forrest putting his foot on the accelerator for less than 5 seconds and eventually braking before hitting Mr. Davis into the wall that eventually caused his death.
So, Mr. Axelson, if yes. I can, because you alluded to kind of I think you especially said we need to look at these facts in light of most favorable to your client when,
yes.
But that's really when assessing the first prong of Strickland, right? Whether the counsel's representation fell below that objective standard.
Yep.
But don't we also just then have to go to the second prong, and that is your client's responsibility to show that there's a reasonable probability that but for the errors, the result would have been different. And that's where I struggle.
I think the case law is actually very favorable for me on that. The case law has been established for a while that prejudice can be shown first based on the fact that the lesser included offense has a shorter prison sentence. But moving on to the other part of the prejudice test, it also is established here when you look at the cases that talk about this Hobson choice, where a jury knows that Mr. Forrest is culpable of something, and clearly he is culpable and should have been convicted of second degree unintentional murder. And you have a trial attorney who argues to the jury that you can find that there's not intent to kill here, but then the jury's in the position of if they find that, they have to acquit him of everything despite their belief that he's culpable of something lesser. And so the attorney was prejudiced Mr. Forrest's defense by not requesting the instruction that more closely fit the facts, by not giving the jury the opportunity to find Mr. Forrest culpable for something lesser than what he was actually convicted of.
Why wasn't that a strategic choice that counsel made? I'm saying, look, I'm going to go for acquittal here. given the fact that your client was stabbed repeatedly.
Well, so I've been doing this for 20 years, and when I stay a case and I go back post-conviction and ask for an evidentiary hearing, I don't do it for fun. I do it because I think the facts establish it, and the facts and the files and everything else don't automatically establish there's no right to an evidentiary hearing, and I feel like that standard is pretty low. Here, the judge didn't rule on the strategy portion of it, didn't find that it was strategy. The state didn't argue to the district court below that this was strategy. They said that they could win on the merits. But I think if this court looks at the state Herrera-Torres case, which I provided in supplemental authorities, in that case, they got an evidentiary hearing. They went in and they asked the attorneys, why didn't you ask for this lesser? And they met the Nix standard in that case because the attorney said, we didn't think about it. We didn't talk to our client about it. If the court has any concerns about strategy here, let's send this thing back and have a hearing, and let's call Mr. Sellers in, and let's see what his explanation is. Let's see if he talked to Mr. Forrest and said, hey, we're going to go for it all, or if he didn't discuss it at all, or if he didn't think about it. And, you know, in these cases, from doing this for 20 years, I can't force a defense attorney to provide an affidavit. All I can do is request an evidentiary hearing. Then I have the power of the court to subpoena that defense attorney, to bring that defense attorney into court and ask them what happened here. And I'm not afraid to do that in this case. I wouldn't have asked for an evidentiary hearing if I didn't think it would have been beneficial to my client. And so I don't know why the district court didn't address the strategy, but it didn't on the first issue. The state didn't argue below on the first issue that it was strategy. So I would say that if this court is contemplating addressing strategy here, that let's send this thing back for an evidentiary hearing, and I'll call Mr. Sellers in, and I'm not afraid of what Mr. Sellers has to say. But again, you know, going back to, there are additional facts too, not just the breaking portion of this.
Let me jump in here because I think it's not just any trial strategy, right? It has to be a viable strategy, or I forget the exact, I'm sure you know.
Reasonable trial strategy, I believe, is the term.
And in this case, as you look at the closing argument, do you see it as presented to the jury as an all or nothing, or is the closing argument itself conceding some portion of criminal liability?
Well, I think the defense attorney and I think the court can look at these facts and think that the accident defense is not very viable. You know, it is something that was brought up by Mr. Forrest, to the police after the incident, saying that, you know, it was slippery out or he slipped on ice. And the defense attorney still made that argument because you can make alternative theories to the jury. But we also know that the defense attorney didn't just focus on that. He did focus on the fact that the jury could find, that this wasn't an intentional killing, that this maybe was an assault, that this wasn't potentially an accident. So he does, to some extent, concede that, this accident thing isn't that viable. And I think we can all, as neutral parties at this point, look at this case and think that's not the strongest argument here. The stronger argument is that in a, after this altercation, in this small space, with a very short period of time with his foot on the accelerator, that this is a person who's trying to seek revenge for an assault that just happened and isn't necessarily contemplating killing that person, but is trying to, assault that person and injure that person. And I think that this court needs to look at the Stilday case, which is in my brief, and it is an unpublished case, but you don't necessarily have to look at it for precedential purposes, but it explains that a jury can look at facts that are more egregious than here, where Mr. Stilday runs into Mrs. Sanchez, knocks, or she ends up on the car, he drives at a high rate of speed, slams on his brakes, she hits her head on the ground when she falls off, then Mr. Stilday backs up and runs her over. In that case, a reasonable jury acquits him of second degree intentional murder but convicts him of the second degree unintentional murder, the same count that we've requested here. So although the court doesn't address that under the lesser included instructions, we know that there the attorney asked for that lesser included instruction and the jury viewed those facts, which are more egregious than the facts here, and doesn't have the lead up of a serious stabbing that lead to the event, and found that that he was not guilty of that more serious offense.
If I may, one just factual distinction I see between those cases, just in looking at the video, he didn't just run into him. It's like he circled in the car the parking lot several times. You know, that seems very different than what happened in Still Day, and perhaps is more indicative of intent than what happened in Still Day. Could you just help me with that?
Well, in Still Day, there's the driving after the person, hitting the person, the intentional act of stopping the person hitting the ground, and then the backing up and then hitting again. Here, there is an attempt to hit him in the closer proximity, which was unsuccessful because of cars and other barriers. It is true that he had the opportunity to leave the parking lot potentially, but is still angry probably over the incident or is in shock, I think is what Belford's testimony was. And that, he does drive after him. But in Still Day, I think the difference between our cases, in Still Day, there's, if he would have stopped with hitting her and then stopping the car and she hits her head and she dies, that would probably be closer. But the fact that Still Day backs up and then runs into her. And again, the supplemental authorities case, which again isn't precedential necessarily here, but provides some context, is the Cruz Ramirez case, where not only does he shoot into this crowd, he sees people falling, and then he stands over them and shoots them, which provides the the intent to kill and the premeditation. And here, there is no additional contact with Mr. Davis after the accident takes place. He doesn't go and try to find Mr. Davis's knife. He doesn't take parts of the wall that have broken off and and attack Mr. Davis. Those things would show the additional intent to kill. And again, when we're looking at this in the light most favorable of the verdict, the state wanted to argue that he hit the brake pedal to minimize his own injury. Again, light most favorable to the verdict is he hit the brake pedal because he wasn't trying to kill Mr. Davis. He was trying to hurt Mr. Davis. He was trying to commit a second degree assault, but he's not trying to kill him in that moment.
If I can jump in on this as well, because if we're looking at whether there's a reasonable basis to acquit, I think Still Day is helpful to show potentially a reasonable basis. In other words, the district court should have, or the attorney should have asked for the instruction. When I'm reading respondent's brief, one of the things that stuck out to me is the argument that that in this case the evidence might show. Or the argument that is made in appellant's brief is that there should be additional evidence of intent, like you were saying, taking a part of the wall or something. And the response to that in the respondent's brief is, well, that by itself isn't enough. There needs to be some actual evidence of no intent, essentially. So I guess I'm asking you, what should the defense attorney do, constitutionally effective defense attorney? Are they required to point to some evidence to support something as opposed to a lack of evidence when they're asking for a lesser included instruction? Or can they just say there's not additional evidence and therefore there's a rational basis?
Well, I don't agree with the state's portrayal of this, that this is just something that was made up in closing argument by the defense attorney. I think the facts that we rely on, including, and I haven't mentioned it yet, but the fact that he shows general empathy when he finds out that Mr. Davis has passed. But those three things combined, the fact that his foot is only on the accelerator for a short period of time, the fact he breaks, the fact he doesn't do anything additional to Mr. Davis and he shows empathy, those are facts in the record. Those aren't a lack of facts, but those are facts in the record that would establish there's an intent to injure but not an intent to kill. So I don't agree with his portrayal that this was just something that Mr. Sellers came up with in closing argument as kind of a one-off argument. I think it is something that was supported by the facts. And again, if we're worried about whether Mr. Sellers did this as an all or nothing proposition, let's send this back for an evidentiary hearing and give me the opportunity to ask him questions about it and see what he has to say. The parties or the state didn't ask for or argue that this was strategy below. I don't believe there's anything in their brief arguing that the district court should have found that this was strategy above, at least on the first issue. With that said, I think that this court can address the merits of this case, and I think that the merits of this case point in our favor, both on the prongs of of ineffective assistance of counsel, both on deficient performance by not requesting this instruction and prejudice in the fact that the jury was left with this Hobson's choice of knowing that Mr. Forrest is culpable of something because of what he did, but not as culpable as the conviction he was convicted of. We would ask for this court to consider both issues, even though I focused on the first issue today, and ask for Mr. Forrest to be granted a new trial. Thank you.
Counsel for respondent, we turn to you next.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to meet you, Judge Wheelock. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Assistant Hennepin County Attorney Adam Petrus, and I represent the respondent in this matter, the state of Minnesota. I would like to highlight two points this morning. First, Strickland and its progeny allow a trial attorney the ability to review the evidence in a case and decide on an objectively reasonable defense to the charged offenses. After viewing the surveillance video in this case that captures appellant driving and smashing his SUV into the victim and crushing him into a brick wall, it was reasonable for any attorney, including appellant's trial counsel, to think that they were unlikely to convince a jury that appellant somehow only intended to hurt but not to kill the victim. And if the members of this court have not had the opportunity to watch trial exhibits 39 and 46, both of which are surveillance video of the victim's death, I implore you to watch them.
What is it about what the vehicle does that you think shows intent, especially in light of Stillday? Because it seems like you're almost having to argue that the result in Stillday, that the jury's verdict was unreasonable.
Your Honor, with all due respect, I understand that juries are presumed to follow instructions, but perhaps, unfortunately, there is no requirement in the law that juries have to act rationally in their verdicts. That's the entire principle behind jury nullification. I don't think that was the right outcome in Stillday, and what I can say about that is what the jury in Stillday decided 22 years ago with different witnesses, different testimony, different evidence, no surveillance video, really has no bearing on what constitutes rational based on the evidence in this case. The second point I wanted to just hit at the beginning relates to the second issue that we haven't had too much of a chance to talk about, but that is that recent case law from this court, binding precedent, Petzold, that holds that the questions that the prosecutor asked KB about what she perceived and then the comments during closing arguments that reference KB's answers to those questions are permissible, and it cannot be constitutionally ineffective assistance for a trial attorney to follow binding precedent from this court and following it by not objecting to those questions and the closing argument comments. To expand on my first point, it is extremely reasonable, after literally watching the crime happen in real time, which is what the surveillance video allowed the jury and everyone involved in this case to do, to believe that the only natural consequence of appellant's driving conduct was to kill the victim, as opposed to only hurting or scaring him. And even if Mr. Axelson or someone else believes the evidence in this case as a whole makes it rational to believe that appellant acted with the intent to hurt but not the intent to kill, that is not the standard that is applied to appellant's ineffective assistance claim. Rather, the standard is whether it was objectively reasonable for someone to believe the opposite. That is, the evidence as a whole did not provide a rational basis to believe that appellant acted only with the intent to hurt, but not the intent to kill. And based on the evidence in this case as a whole, especially those surveillance videos, believing that there was not a rational basis that appellant acted with the intent to hurt, but not the intent to kill, that was objectively reasonable. I guess I want to touch on a couple things here. In terms of the Cruz-Ramirez citation in the supplemental authority letter, that's similar to the Bercier case that appellant had also cited on page 12 of his principal brief, and that was an argument that Judge Chu rejected in her post-conviction order. And just because there was not that additional level that was taken in terms of ending Mr. Davis's life does not mean that the act was not intentional. There's no minimum like threshold that needs to be passed there. And I thought Judge Tu did a good job of explaining why that is. I mean, the takeaway here is that the Sixth Amendment, you know, which is again the basis for both of appellant's claims, did not require that appellant's trial counsel act that the evidence as a whole provided a rational basis to acquit appellant of intentional murder. If appellant was holding a gun at point-blank range with the victim, and he pointed that gun down at the victim's knee, as opposed to as compared to, say, his chest or his head, well, then there'd be a very rational argument that he was intending to injure the victim, but not to kill him. That's not what happened in this case. Please watch the video. Appellant drove an SUV over 20 miles per hour directly at the victim as he was in the corner of a parking lot, directly in front of a concrete brick wall. He hit him with enough force. You can see in the trial exhibits, the photos, that bricks were strewn all about. The front end of the SUV was totaled. There is no other conclusion that could be rational based on this evidence other than the intent was to kill. This case law, Cooper, which I cite in my brief, recognizes that juries are allowed to infer, you know, we are allowed to infer the natural and probable consequences of intentional acts. And that's precisely what happened here. It would be very difficult to argue with a straight face to a jury after watching that video with them that that was only an intent to hurt or to scare, but not to kill. And building on one point,
What did defense counsel actually argue?
Defense counsel used the argument that was kind of set in stone to an extent by appellant's Miranda interview, where he claimed it was accidental. That was one of the arguments that was made over the course of the 30-page...
I guess I'm just trying to get you back to where you were before, that it's not so much... Our decision isn't what would a jury believe about it. Our decision is what would a defense attorney believe a jury would believe when watching the video, right? We're layered because of the ineffective assistance counsel, right?
Right, it's even more layered than that, Judge Bryan, because it's what would be objectively reasonable for that defense attorney to do. Not what you would do as a defense attorney or I would do as a defense attorney, but what would be objectively reasonable in light of all of the evidence in the case. So it is rather layered given that it's in the ineffective assistance of context. Returning to my second point about the recent case law from this court, Patzold does not directly conflict with the case law that appellant cites in his brief or in his supplemental authority letter. If you read Petzl, it's based on the clear language of Minnesota Rule of Evidence 701 and 704. KB's testimony was rationally based on her own perceptions inside of appellant's SUV, which is exactly what those rules of evidence authorize. Petzl actually also references the Supreme Court's analysis in DeWald that the officer's opinions about who killed a victim is permissible testimony when their testimony and conclusions was factual rather than legal. And KB's testimony, if you read it on pages 116 to 117, and again on 140 to 141 of the trial transcript, that was very factual rather than legal. Patzold is consistent with the Supreme Court's pronouncement in Bauer, which I cite on page 23 of my brief, that is wholly permissible for a witness to testify about whether an act itself is intentional as opposed to accidental. And it's also consistent with this court's previous presidential decision in PAC, P-A-K, which I cite on page 21 of my brief, that holds that a deputy could testify as to his opinion that an assault occurred based on the deputy's observations at the crime scene. KB testified that appellant intended to hit the victim with the SUV, and then the prosecutor in closing argument argued that KB's testimony about that intent to hit meant that appellant intended to kill because that was the reasonable and natural consequence, and a person intends the natural and probable consequence of what they intentionally do. And so ramming the SUV into the victim and crushing him against the brick wall in the manner that appellant did, the only natural and probable consequence of that, again, if you watch it happen, is that the victim was going to lose his life.
If I can jump in and ask a follow-up regarding, there's trial strategy as to both potential problems here, right? And so my question for you is, do we need a hearing? In other words, are we concerned about subjectively what that attorney was, what was the subjective trial strategy, or are we instead applying an objective standard to determine what a strategy could have been?
I believe it's the latter. It's an objective strategy. And responding specifically to the question about whether an evidentiary hearing was warranted on the post-conviction petition, the answer is no. And in terms of the Nix standard, in Nix, it was clear from the record in that case at the time that the evidentiary hearing was requested that the trial counsel in that case wanted to obtain a witness's cell phone records to support the defense and actually made several partial attempts to obtain those cell phone records. But despite the acknowledged pivotal role that the cell phone records were going to play in the case and that were playing during the police investigation, that defense attorney either never obtained or did not read the Sprint's response to the subpoena for the cell phone records. Those are all facts that were provided to the post-conviction court, either in the post-conviction petition or in supporting documents at the time an evidentiary hearing was requested. We have no such factual allegations in this case. And I understand Mr. Axelson's point that he cannot force the defense attorney in this case, trial counsel Paul Sellers, to provide an affidavit. That is true. That is typically not what warrants or justifies evidentiary hearings on post-conviction claims involving ineffective assistance. Rather, it's affidavits or information from people that Mr. Axelson could get information from. For instance, appellant. If there was discussion, like appellant, for instance, makes in his brief to this court, not to the district court, but in his brief to this court, about, you know, asking for an authorized use of force jury instruction. If that had been included in affidavit in a post-conviction petition and presented to the district court, well, yes, then there may have been a factual allegation that would warrant Mr. Sellers coming in and saying whether or not he recalled that conversation taking place. There are no factual allegations here that would justify an evidentiary hearing. There, again, as I was explaining before, Mr. Sellers watched the surveillance video. We know that because it was played in court, and he definitely, you know, was present there. He obviously was familiar with the evidence in this case, and there was no indication that he strayed from the law regarding, you know, what it means to intend to commit a crime in terms of Cooper, or what it means to have testimony come in about what a witness perceived firsthand, or about whether or not he should have objected when the prosecutor was following the law as this court has laid it out in its precedential opinions. So there's no factual basis that's been provided to the post-conviction court that would warrant an evidentiary hearing, which is why Judge Chu properly denied that request. In terms of Mr. Sellers' closing argument, he provided a full-throated defense. And what I mean by that is he requested a lesser-included offense. He pre-requested heat of passion, first-degree manslaughter, because he thought that fit the facts, potentially. He also attacked and criticized in those 30 pages of his closing argument really every aspect of the evidence and of the state's case. He did try to address, you know, every conceivable alternative way that a jury could interpret the evidence. And the Sixth Amendment does not require that trial counsel have to request a lesser-included offense to match every conceivable alternative way that a jury could interpret the evidence. Those comments that are highlighted in appellant's brief referring to if you find that appellant was intending to hurt but not to kill the victim, well, then you still have to acquit. That those are accurate, legally accurate statements in his closing argument, but those are also just on two different pages, again, of a 30-page closing argument. And this court seems like it is familiar with that closing argument and the fact that there are a number of different responses that were provided to ways of poking holes in the state's case. And just because there were a number of different ways that were suggested that the state had failed to carry its burden on the three counts, some of them which landed because there was an acquittal, obviously, on the top count, first-degree premeditated murder, does not mean a lesser-included offense needs to be requested on every single alternative argument. I see I have about a minute left. I am happy to answer any questions that this court has on the case law that appellant cites, on other claims that were raised in appellant's pro se briefs, or about anything else regarding the ineffective assistance arguments. But seeing no further questions, I would simply ask that you affirm appellant's conviction. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, counsel. And we will turn to appellant's counsel for the last word.
Thank you. I bet my burden of proof to get an evidentiary hearing when I submitted to the district court that Mr. Sellers argued there's no proof that Mr. Forrest acted with the purpose of causing death. Now, some of you could watch the video and say, well, the way Mr. Davis was moving, the way he drove through the poles and applied the brakes, I think he was trying to hurt or maim him, okay? This is the attorney who was present during this case. He watched the video, and he argued to the district court the exact theory that I'm arguing that he should have requested that the jury should have been instructed on. The respondent's counsel here may not agree with the still day verdict. He may also not agree with the acquittal on first degree murder here. So we do have a jury here where if you just look at the facts and you weren't on the jury and you didn't see all the evidence come in, that may say, if you only look at the driving conduct, yes, maybe that should have been first degree intentional murder. But we have a jury that rejected that. Okay, we have a jury that looked at all the factors that led up to that, that looked at the stabbing, that looked at the cat and mouse game that happened prior to him hitting Mr. Davis. And so, you know, we met that standard. We should have gotten an evidentiary hearing. If this court just wants to look at the merits, we've met both prongs of ineffective assistance of counsel here. And in this court, you know, in a situation like the one of the cases I cited in my supplemental authorities involved the stabbing in an apartment. In that kind of case, the reason the defense lost on prejudice in that case is because a stabbing in a small apartment, there's less of an argument to be made that it's not an intentional killing. If it's a shooting, again, like the case in the supplemental authorities where it's a shooting, obviously there's more of a like an assumption that there's an intent to kill. Here we have a defense attorney who doesn't think that the state's met that burden and makes three paragraphs of argument and closing argument, making that argument, but without providing the jury with an instruction that fits the culpability that Mr. Forrest had in this case. And the Supreme Court has said that that's not sufficient. And I just add just quickly and then I'll sit down, is that our Supreme Court has said many times for district courts to stop just rejecting our post-conviction petitions without an evidentiary hearing. It's a waste of everybody's time to keep sending these things back. They should grant us our evidentiary hearings. Let's get everybody in and get the testimony out, and then I'd like to hear them try to argue strategy and that this was reasonable and this is not what Mr. Sellers was thinking. I'm at a disadvantage when I don't get my evidentiary hearing, when I don't get something that I'm deserving of. In this case, when I meet the standard under 590, the Supreme Court has said those hearings should be granted favorably, and in close cases, we get the benefit of the doubt. Here, I met that standard by showing Mr. Sellers' closing argument, and his failure to make that request was unreasonable in this case. And we'd ask that this court either remand this for an evidentiary hearing, as we requested, or if you agree with the district court and the prosecutor here that we can decide this on the merits, that we win on the merits, that this should be reversed because we've met the standard of ineffective assistance of counsel on the first issue. Thank you.
Well, thank you both for your time and your arguments here today. We certainly appreciate it. The court will take this matter under advisement, and we will issue an opinion within the 90-day frame or the applicable statutory time.